had to duck to enter the chamber, but the room's contents held no surprises for the rangers. "I regret that I cannot accompany you. You may take anything you wish. I hope that it serves you well and brings you back to the axe." Asher raised an eyebrow. "Anything I like. This is my locker." Glade patted the old assassin on the back. "Well, after you stocked it so well all these years, we felt it could be something more. I bet that hip of yours is feeling mighty light." Russell eyed the gap on Asher's left hip and guided him to the alcove lined with identical blades. Rena inspected the row of green cloaks and broadswords. "This is very you." "I know what I like, and I like what I know." Asher proceeded to replace his cloak and choose a new sword. "And for you, Lady Phelan." Russell gestured across the room. "I have everything I require, but thank you." Phelan touched the light sack on her back. Quite impossibly, that sack housed a large chest with various supplies, though having seen Phelan in a fight, Nathaniel knew well that the only thing the elf needed was the scimitar on her hip. Nathaniel went straight into the alcove, eager to be rid of his flowing cloak. The knight went for the tough brown leather jacket, with gaps around the shoulders and the elbows, perfect for an archer. The edges of the leather were engraved with a swirling pattern that looked better suited to an elf than a human. "Good choice," Glade observed. "That jacket will stop a blade." "But not an arrow," Asher added, sliding his new broadsword into the scabbard on his hip. Nathaniel put the jacket on and fitted a pair of hardened braces over the sleeves, offering extra protection for up-close fighting. Glade continued, "You're going to find life a little harder without that famous coat of yours." The bald ranger handed over two straps lined with short daggers. "Strap these to your legs. They'll get you out of a pinch." With some fingerless gloves and a new quiver for his back, Nathaniel felt right at home among the rangers. Rena, like Phelan, remained by the door, more than happy with her elven attire and weapons. Nathaniel had marveled at the craftsmanship a few times during their time together, and could see how resilient their intricate leather was. "That's quite the bow on your back," Glade observed over Rayna's shoulder. "It has power." Hadavad tilted his head, with his eyes fixed on the black bow. "I claimed it after I used it to kill Adelambovo." Rayna twisted her head to see the top of the weapon on her back. "And it is definitely powerful." Asher joined them with his hand resting under the spiked pommel of his sword and a fresh green cloak over his shoulders. Along with the two short swords on his back, the ranger cut quite the fierce figure, and that was without knowing that the blades on his back were among the most unique in all of Ilion. "Are we ready?" Phelan was growing impatient. "We will need the horses for our journey, so a secluded place in the Evermore would be ideal for opening the portal." The elf looked to Asher for any ideas, but it was Glade who replied. "We can show you a good place," the old ranger stated with a smile. "We know all the good places." To Nathaniel's surprise, the entire group of rangers accompanied them beyond the tree line, even Bale, son of Hyle. The companions received many looks on their way out of Lirion, though Nathaniel noticed that most were staring at Doran, riding atop his warthog. The night was more comfortable with the city behind them and the thick wood of trees quickly surrounding them. He wondered how far Caleb had travelled by now. Was he close to Darkwell? Was he lying in a ditch somewhere, drunk into a stupor? Nathaniel put the thought aside and focused on the journey ahead of them. He had done all he could to look out for the surviving Greycoats, and he had his own journey to worry about. "This will do," Fenton announced after half an hour of trotting into the forest. They had come across a small clearing, littered with man-sized boulders and covered in green moss. The leaves were already raining down around them as winter loomed ever closer. Winter would be a distant memory after a few days in the Aridlands, however. Their winter was still hotter than any summer in the north of Ilion. "You best be making that portal big enough for me, Ogelf," Doran said with a big grin. "Excuse me?" Phelan looked to Asher again. Glade cleared his throat. "What Doran is trying to say is, we have decided to accompany you. All of us." Asher looked to Salim, with a hint of surprise in his expression. "I would not have you tell my son of my story, and yet remain absent from what is perhaps the most important quest in history." Selim looked to Rayna with a warm smile. "And I would not have name left out of story." Bale's thick accent wasn't easy to understand, but his intentions were clear enough. "And I'm coming because my blade's been clean for too long." Doran laughed to himself. his whole body shaking inside his black and golden armor. Nathaniel noted that Glade offered no explanation, just a simple nod to Asher. Out of them all, it appeared the pair had more history. Before Phelan could protest, Rayna stepped forward. "You do not have the gratitude of your people yet, but when our actions bring peace to all of Verda, your names and courage will be sung throughout history," the elven princess beamed. "For who could stand against us?" Indeed, Nathaniel thought. Despite Russell staying behind, those standing in the clearing were among the most skilled and deadliest in the land. Perhaps they could survive the arid lands and the Arrakesh. The knight still didn't want to think about the nightmarish creatures that Asher told of inside the pit. Phelan protested, "I cannot transport us all through the same portal to Carath. It will cause too much stress on the portal, and I don't have the strength to open more than one this day." "We will do it together," Rayna replied with confidence. "You have never succeeded in opening a portal, in the right place. Then at least use my strength." Rayna wasn't taking no for an answer. "Very well. Is everyone ready?" the elf asked. Hadavad moved forward atop his horse of pure black with a giddy expression. Russell Mabry stepped away from the horses. "I'll have a tankard of ale waiting for all of you. Make sure you return to drink it, eh?" Asher looked to the owner of the pickaxe with what passed for a thank you from the ranger. "We must be quick." Phelan removed the crystal from the pouch on her belt. The light broke through the gaps in her fingers, as if the elf held a star in her hand. Phelan flicked her wrist and launched the crystal out in front of the group. With a deafening crack and a brilliant flash of every color, the crystal exploded and expanded into a black abyss lined with silent bolts of lightning. Hadavad was the first to gallop ahead, eager to experience this new form of magic. The remaining nine spurred their horses, and a hog, through the portal with all haste. Nathaniel had traveled through one before, but it didn't stop the dizzying wave wash over him when reality reformed around his galloping horse. The brief moment of shadow was obliterated by the startling blue sky and brilliant sunshine. Nathaniel blinked hard to adjust his eyes and brought his horse to a stop alongside the others. When his eyes found the faces of the rangers, Nathaniel felt his stomach drop at their expressions, like wild cats with their hackles up. The knight turned in his saddle and followed their gaze across the endless green fields of the moonlit plains. The portal was already gone, allowing for a clear vision of the centaurs 100 yards away. "We're not in the arid lands," Glade observed, never taking his eyes off the centaurs, who were all equally staring at the companions. "We're in the moonlit plains," Nathaniel replied, unable to count the number of centaurs amassing in front of them. "I couldn't..." Phelan slid from her horse, only to be caught by Asher mid-fall. The elf appeared exhausted and paler than usual. That was all the centaurs needed, apparently, as the mob burst into a gallop with their bows raised and stolen swords at the ready. Their howls and cheers were beyond what any man could achieve, and only served to put a chill down Nathaniel's spine. "Ride south!" Glade shouted. Asher heaved Phelan's limp form over his saddle and threw her horse's reins to Atharia, who ushered it to run alongside her own. With the added weight, Hector galloped at the back of the group, with Asher's determined look showing no signs of fear. It was only a few seconds later when the first arrows began to whistle past their heads. Nathaniel looked ahead, surprised with the speed of Doran's hog, which sprinted and weaved between the horse's powerful legs. Rayna led from the front, with her blonde hair flying out behind her, and Adelan's bow glistening under the sun. Nathaniel wanted to ride beside her so he could ensure her safety, a responsibility he felt tenfold since Phelan's collapse. The ground thundered under the stampede of hooves. Every time Nathaniel looked back, it appeared as if the centaurs had swelled in size. The plains were predominantly flat, dotted with small forests and ancient rocks, but the centaurs dashed out from behind every cover until they were charging at the companions from all sides. One arrow flew between Asher and Nathaniel and skimmed the edge of the knight's new jacket. "Stay low," Asher commanded. "They won't risk hitting the horses." "How do they feel about hogs?" Doran shouted back as his warthog dashed between falling arrows. The small woods ahead of them exploded with life when dozens of centaurs leapt onto the plains. The companions' collective speed instantly slowed as they were quickly surrounded. Nathaniel kept looking to Hadavad and Atharia, who out of the group were the most qualified to get them out of the trap. But the mages slowed with the others and came to a complete stop. The companions were herded into a tight circle, until the green of the plains were hidden behind a wall of centaurs. Nathaniel couldn't help staring at them all, having never seen one this close before. Everything below the navel was that of a horse, but their torsos were quite distinctive. Every one of them was well-muscled and covered in thick tribal tattoos of varying colors. Their heads were human in appearance, with hard lines and scraggy beards, but their ears were pointed, like that of an elf. Instead of a mane, the centaurs had long braids that ran down their human backs. The centaur with the broadest chest and longest braid stepped forward with a bow in hand. His mouth opened as if to speak, when his dark eyes flicked to Rayna and fixed his gaze. For a moment, Nathaniel didn't know what to do. The princess was on the other side of the circle, and if the giant centaur attacked her, he wouldn't be able to help. "El Shaddai," the centaur whispered, before bending one of his powerful legs and stretching out the other to bow. All the other centaurs whispered the same word and bowed as one. "What's this about?" Doran said out of the corner of his mouth. The head centaur looked up at Rayna. "You are El Shaddai, an elf." Doran, son of Dorian, looked around quizzically. "Does this mean we're not going to die?" The void collapsed behind him, and Valinus dropped into the shadows of Caliban's caves. The Herald of the Gods had once loved these caves, when they were full of wonder and power. Then they became his prison for 40 years, the only place he could exist without being consumed. The pools were always warm and welcoming, made entirely of crystals that weren't quite solid yet. Now Valinus looked upon them with a growing hatred. After decades, he had finally roamed the world again, free and superior. But he wasn't strong enough. Valinus fell to his knees at the foot of the nearest pool, its light reflecting off his iron mask. He had spent days underground, scouring Stowhold's secret vaults, countering hexes and spellbound doors. The Herald of the Gods had searched through chamber after chamber of trinkets, ancient coins and treasures that only a human could ever value. The occasional guard would venture down when they had plucked up the courage to pursue him, but all had found their resting place in those cold tombs. Day and night, the gods had ceaselessly bombarded him with their demands to find the only treasure that really mattered. The weight of the pantheon was taking its toll without the entirety of Paldora's gem to keep his mind and body intact. He looked up to the glittering stalactites and cursed Aladir, the head of his trusted hand. "Aladir!" he screamed into the caves. "Where is it? I need the gem!" Valinus scraped the mask from his glowing face and looked up, as if the gods were standing before him. "Without the gem, I cannot retrieve the veil. I am failing you." "Find the ranger. Find the gem. Find the veil." Atilan's voice dominated that of Paldora and Nias. The king of the gods demanded the veil to be found, and so it must be. But without the gem, Valinus knew the magic would consume him. "Find the ranger." Paldora's sweet voice whispered in his ear. The herald cursed the outlander, wondering how a savage from the wild moors could be so entwined with his own fate. "Master!" Thallon, Padron of the Sword, ran through the tunnel. His emerald blade, gifted to him by Valinus, was resting on his hip as always. "Thallon!" Valinus took his subject's hand and pulled himself to his feet. "Help me to the pools." Thallon helped his master to remove his robes and mask before Valinus fell into the sparkling pool. The relief was instantaneous. The dark elf stayed under the magical waters for a moment, allowing his strength to return and any risk of seizure die away. When he finally rose above the surface, Thallon was waiting eagerly by the edge, his pale features marred with concern. "Has there been any word from Aladir?" Valinus rasped. "No, master." There was some joy in Thallon's response. The ranger's fate remains unknown to him. He has met with the council in Carath. Both he and Nakir are preparing to open Scylla's gate. Valinus sighed. "They will not be able to open those gates. I see that now. Even I have not the power to undo the spells cast over it." Thallon hesitated. "But then, how will the Darkerkin enter the arid lands?" Valinus smiled. "I believe the gods have already answered that question, Thallon. You, however, will just have to have faith." It was clear that Thallon had more questions, but the elf remained silent, trusting in his master. As the general made to leave, he turned back to the pools and asked, "Master, what have you been searching for? I could feel you in Dragorn and then in Stowhold." Valenis began to sink back into the pool. "Faith, Thallon. You must have faith." Chapter 17. Upon the Edge of a Blade. Torrin skulked on the landing, leaning over the dusty rail, as he looked down at the orphans being herded together and counted by the older children. They had been escorted from the orphanage in groups like this one for the last 2 days, taken to secret places of refuge elsewhere in the city. As the children departed, the owls arrived from across the arid lands in similar groups to avoid arousing suspicion. Tregaron, the most northern city in the desert, was the only place that hadn't yet been completely emptied of his agents. But they would soon arrive. Then they would go to war, in earnest. He met the eyes of every owl, each as young as him, and nodded his thanks. They had all grown accustomed to the cities Torrin had sent them to, and it was asking a lot for them to abandon any plans and ride for Carrath at a moment's notice. They were loyal, he thought proudly. Every one of them was loyal, not just to the cause, but to him personally. Torrin had used Salim's techniques to train all of them, ensuring they could each do more than just defend themselves. He had turned them all into killers, and he didn't regret it for a single second. His only regret was the size of his force. Torrin looked at their faces and wondered which of them wouldn't make it through this. This part of his plan had always involved more owls and several more years of preparation. These were his brothers and sisters, people he had grown up with on the streets, people he had survived with. "You look troubled, my boy." Mother Medakiai came to stand by the railing. Most of her body was hidden beneath robes and a colourful headscarf, revealing only her wrinkled face and welcoming brown eyes. Her years in the desert had hardened her skin, and Torrin knew that was the truth in more ways than one. "I'm asking a lot of them." "You think they aren't ready?" Mother Medakiai asked, skeptically. "I'm not sure any of us are ready for what's coming." Torrin thought about the approaching Darkakin army and the unbelievable appearance of the elves. "What do you think, Mother?" He had valued her opinion for as long as he could remember. Mother Medakiai thought for a moment. "I think they have been freeing slaves every day since you trained them, and I know you trained them well." Torrin glanced at the mother, aware of the disapproval in her voice, though not with him, but rather with Salim al-Anan, for training him in the first place. The two had never quite agreed on Salim taking Torrin under his wing as a teenager, and Mother Medakiai had made that quite clear to the older warrior on more than one occasion. "However," Mother Medakiai continued, with a somber tone, "if what Halion says is true and history is accurate, the Darkakin will make the slavers irrelevant. There will be no free people left to fight when they are finished with our land." Torrin digested her wise words. "So you think we should do this? You think we should take the palace?" "I think the House of Owls stands on the edge of a blade. You will either take the palace, and our ranks will swell until all are free, or you will fail, and the House of Owls will be wiped from history by the new dawn. It's going to be quite the night." Mother Medakiai added some levity and a smile to her serious speech. Despite his sour mood, Torrin couldn't help but be infected by that smile. Mother Medakiai rested her head on his shoulder and wrapped her hands around his arm. They enjoyed a moment together, mother and adopted son. In truth, she was closer in age to be his grandmother. But even to this day, Torrin had never met his parents or discovered which grand family they belonged to. "I will be going with the last group of children," Mother Medakiai commented as she moved away. "Try not to get my house too dirty." She stopped on the landing and looked back. "You must return to me, Torrin." The mother's expression and tone suggested she wasn't to be argued with. "And make sure everyone wipes their feet on the way in." Torrin could only see the back of her when she made her last remark, but it still made him smile. A sharp whistle from the hall below caught Torrin's attention. Brego was standing in the middle of the hall, with alarm spreading across his face. "The lookouts have spotted a lone soldier walking this way." "A curious thing. On his own?" Torrin's question was met with a nod. "Stop the last group of children from leaving and hide their bags. Keep the owls in the back and—" "He's got a white band around his arm," Brego interrupted, aware of the fabric's significance. Hylian and Torin had come up with several methods of contacting one another over the years, one of which was a soldier he trusted with a white cloth around his arm. This was unexpected, though. Hylian himself was supposed to be coming at sunset to finalize the details of the attack. Divert him through the back, have the lookouts retrace his steps and make certain he wasn't followed. Torin dashed to the other side of the orphanage, leaving Brago to carry out his orders. A few minutes later, the soldier was being bundled through a back door and surrounded by Torin and three armed owls. In the tussle, one of the owls slid the soldier's sword from its scabbard and pushed him against the wall. They weren't taking any chances with so many of their forces in one place. "A nice day for a walk," Torin said. If the soldier didn't give the correct response, he would never see home again. "I was hoping for rain," the soldier replied with some trepidation. Torin let his shoulders relax, and he dismissed the owls, giving Brago a nod in the doorway. The soldier realized that he wasn't about to die, and removed his short pointed helmet and held it under his arm, inspecting the surroundings. "Not what you expected." Torin looked around the cramped room, full of junk collected over the decades. "I can't believe you've nearly toppled an empire from inside this. I thought it was..." "Why has Hylian sent you?" Torin didn't have time for long-winded observations. The soldier stood a little straighter, not used to being spoken to in this manner, and especially by someone out of uniform. Torin tried to appear less tense, and remembered that it was a miracle that there were any soldiers who disagreed with slavery. He should be thankful that Hylian had even got through to as many as he had. Torin wanted to free the slaves. He didn't want to cripple the country by eradicating its forces and killing people's husbands, brothers, and sons. The arid lands only stood a chance of surviving after the new regime if there were people left to live in it. "Forgive me." Torin held up a hand. "My responsibilities have increased today. My name is Torin, son of Nun." The soldier bowed slightly, as if accepting his apology. "My name is Argo Norvalin. Commander Hylian has sent me with his regrets. He cannot attend tonight's... meeting." "Why not?" Torin asked immediately. "Supreme Commander Rorsash has invited him to dinner in the palace. He has sent me with the details you require to take the palace." Argo revealed a rolled-up scroll inside his breastplate. "So while we fight for our lives, he's going to enjoy some fine dining?" Torrin's temper was rising again. This was just typical of his brother. "He would fall under suspicion if he were to decline." Argo rose to his commander's defense, as any owl would do for Torin. "Emperor Faro will be present for the meal." Was that Hallian's game? While they secured the palace, he would secure the boy emperor. More likely, he would enjoy the meal and wait for Torin to do all the hard work. "So he sends you in his place, in the middle of the day, and dressed in full armor, no less." Torin looked Argo up and down, still slave to his temper. "I wasn't followed." "We will determine that," Torin snapped. "There are still those among your ranks who believe slavery is a natural way of life. They might find it suspicious, in a time of rebellion, for one of their own to go for a stroll on his own in a neighborhood where entire battalions don't dare tread." "I wasn't followed," Argo replied firmly. "Torin." Brago was standing in the doorway again. "Every owl from Havona to Amaraska are accounted for." Torin took a breath to calm himself. "What of Tregaron?" "Most of them will be here by sunset." Brago glanced at Argo with a critical eye. Torin bade Argo to follow him and Brago into the hall where the children usually had their meals. Now it was filled to burst with just over 400 owls. The white owl turned to the soldier. "Perhaps we should go over these... details." The centaurs had led the group of rangers and elves across the moonlit plains to a hidden clearing within one of the smaller forests. The centaurs had built humble shelters, filled mostly with straw and gathered food. Despite all the horrible things humans said about the bloodthirsty creatures, Rayna could only see vegetables and fruit dotted around the camp. The center of the site was occupied by a large pyre that made most hearths look relatively inadequate by comparison. The sun was on its way down when the princess felt she could leave Phelan in the hands of the centaurs. Rayna had spent most of the day keeping watch over her and using magic where she could to restore Phelan's energy, but her magical talents had always fared better on physical wounds. Two centaurs crowded around Phelan and applied their herbal medicines to her skin and offered prayers to the gods for restoration. Dark rings marred her mentor's eyes, and her pale complexion had turned almost ghostly now. Opening a portal to transport so many had been too taxing, even with Rayna's combined efforts. Rayna was angry with herself for not taking more time to practice the art of magic. The princess had always taken to her bow or a sword, allowing her natural magic ability to fall by the wayside.
"It's not your fault."
Surprisingly, it was Asher and not Nathaniel waiting for her outside the hut.
"Don't blame yourself."
The ranger's cool blue eyes put Rayna at ease as they strolled across the camp together. "If only you still had your ring." Rayna looked at Asher's hand, noticeably absent of Paldora's gem. "You could have restored her with no effort at all, or even opened a portal all the way to nightfall."
"Even with the shard, I was still a novice in the ways of magic."
Asher was among the hardest of humans to read, giving little expression to his words.
"I think it would still have been safer to allow Phelan to open the portals, even if she needs time to recover."
"She likes you, you know." Rayna didn't know exactly why she said that. "She enjoys your company, that is. She doesn't show it. She's almost as hard to read as you are. But she does like you." Their conversation came to an end when they reached the others, who had all huddled together so that they might better observe the wild centaurs that trotted around the camp. Doran had already started a small fire and was busy preparing a spit, when Hadavad advised him to put it away in favor of eating something that had never acquired a heartbeat. The dwarf was about to protest when a pair of centaurs walked by and eyed the spit with disgust. The broad-chested centaur, who had introduced himself as Zastus and met them on the plains, stepped in front of Rayna and Asher.
"Princess Rayna."
The centaur's voice was deep and rich. "My people are preparing a feast tonight, in honor of the El Shanae's return to these lands. Your friends are welcome to partake." There was clearly a lot of distrust and bloody history between the centaurs and humanity. Rayna decided that it would be one of the first matters she attended to when the war was averted and peace finally reigned over Ilion and Ada. "Thank you, Zastus. The honor will be ours, I assure you." Rayna bowed her head and watched with real wonder as the chief centaur walked away. They were truly magnificent creatures. Asher observed, "For all the trouble you're going to be in with your own people, you make a good princess."
"Princess."
Rayna smiled at the compliment. "I learned from my mother that leading is just another word for serving. My father is more concerned with words such as rule and control, but he sees the world through different eyes." The latter brought a sadness to her tone.
"Perhaps he has simply seen too much over his long lifetime. Aging around bloodshed has a way of narrowing one's view."
Rayna smiled briefly. "You speak too eloquently for a simple ranger, you know. It gives away your prior training."
Asher matched her smile. "It adds to the mystery."
Rayna's laugh was mirthless as she considered her father. "My father has indeed seen a lot, especially living through the Dark War. I can't help but feel, however, that new eyes are required for a new time. He is living in the past, where all the violence and wars should have stayed."
"Would you take his place?" Asher inquired.
Rayna had asked herself the same question many times over the years. "Elven hierarchy is somewhat violent. Another addition implemented by my father. If he were to die or abdicate, my mother, Adelandra, would take the throne. If they both abdicated or died, I would no doubt be assassinated and replaced by one of the highborn families. I have long been considered too weak for elven society."
"It seems to me that you are more elf than any other. Without having lived it, you alone remember the old ways of your people.
I have lived around violence my whole life and seen what it has to offer. The road you would choose for your people may be the only one that sees us find some semblance of peace. Or at least learn to tolerate each other."
"You mean as I tolerate you?"
Rayna jested, with a hint of a smile turning up her cheeks. The ranger played along and pretended to be hurt, but the princess placed an affectionate hand on his arm. "Never have I had more hope in my heart than when I met you and Nathaniel. Together we have the chance to make a real change. But tonight, we have a feast among new friends. Under the stars, no less. I hope you weren't planning on anything too civilized."
Asher looked at the rangers with a coy smile.
Indeed, Asher had been right. As the sun dropped below the horizon and the grass beneath their feet glowed under its ancient enchantment,
the group of rangers introduced the centaurs to alcohol. For the first time in centuries, the centaurs enjoyed their time with the two legs and shared food and drink alike. Reyna returned to Phelan regularly to check on her condition, though the princess knew she needed sleep more than anything. As the moon rose higher and its glow illuminated the fluorescent grass, the centaurs took up a dance around the pyre to celebrate the elves. Reyna couldn't help but smile and laugh under the canopy of stars. For just a moment, she felt as if she was back in Ada, celebrating at one of the festivals in the Amara forest. Nathaniel appeared from nowhere and gripped her by both hands, pulling the princess into the dance with the centaurs. They laughed and danced together as if there was nothing else going on in the world. Off to the side of the dance, the barbarian, Bale, was sat opposite a crouching centaur as the two contested each other's strength with an arm wrestle. The barbarian cried to the gods for strength, but the centaur slowly pushed the man's arm down with casual ease. Doran spat out his ale in laughter and dropped to his behind, which wasn't so far from the ground to begin with. Asher and Glade sat with Salim, still in control of their senses and deep in discussion by the looks of it. For Reyna, the whole world was spinning as she danced with Nathaniel. The princess caught glimpses of Hadavad and Dotharia closer to the pyre, talking to Zastus with great interest. It was some hours before the dancing was broken up by the mad dash of a notorious warthog. The animal ran between the centaurs, squealing with glee and a shining coat of ale over its face and tusks. "Hey!" Nathaniel shouted, lifting his leg in time to avoid the hog. "Doran! What do you call it?" The dwarf stopped laughing with a confounded expression. "What do I call it?" Nathaniel laughed. "Yes, the warthog's name." "Bah! I see no warthog. This is a warhog. Bred in Denaheim for, well, war." Reyna couldn't contain her amusement. "The poor creature has no name?" Doran Heavybelly shrugged. "Well, aye, it does. Sometimes I just call it hog or pig." The dwarf swigged his ale. "Sometimes I just whistle." The companions fell into fits of laughter before returning to the feast. It was much later by the time Reyna retired for the night. The centaurs had left Phelan to rest when Nathaniel joined her in sitting beside her mentor and keeping watch. The princess didn't know if it was the ale Doran kept pouring into her cup or not, but the elf looked at Nathaniel, and for the first time she didn't think about their differences. She didn't care about their different lifespans, or the fact that she was falling for a human instead of an elf, never mind the fact that she wasn't even royalty. Reyna looked at his strong, stubble jaw and dark eyes, and knew that what she felt was in fact love. These moments of peace and enjoyment were going to be few and far between after tonight. They had gotten lucky with the centaur's change of heart today, but there would be no such luck once they entered the desert. A part of Reyna was looking forward to seeing the Southern Kingdom and observing how the humans had thrived in a land the elves naturally avoided, but there was a part of her that wanted to run away with Nathaniel into the Evermore and never look back. Reyna looked at Phelan and drew some strength from her mentor's resolve. After all, they were not the only ones fighting to keep the peace. The princess thought of her mother, who was somewhere in the south of Ada, a world away. Her mother had sacrificed much to the dragons, leaving her home behind and all the comfort that befit a queen, an inspiration to all elves. Reyna knew that the life she wanted with Nathaniel was worth fighting for, even if she didn't know what that looked like yet. First they would fight to bring an end to Valinus's machinations, and then strike an accord between man and elf, so that peace might reign again. Reyna fell asleep in Nathaniel's arms, and dreamt about what could be. Chapter 18. Insurrection. Midnight had come and gone by the time Toran, son of Nun, was in position outside the palace. After finalizing the plan and going over the details of the patrols and the layout inside the fortress-like palace with Argo, Toran had ordered the owls into various positions throughout the day, to avoid suspicion. After all, 400 rebel slaves walking through the streets would draw the entire army out of their barracks. Every hour, the owls had left the orphanage in small groups and waited patiently for the day they had all been training for. Toran looked over the edge of the building to see Argo striding through the main gate, the only way in and out through the surrounding wall that protected the palace. The soldier had assured him that the men on the gate tonight were loyal to Halion, though he had owls on all sides of the wall with grappling equipment. The plan was simple, he reminded himself. First, they take the grounds and replace the guards, armor and all. The guards at the front seal the gates after the elves go in to ensure the rest of the barracks don't come to any aid if an alarm is raised. Then, while the bulk of the force works their way up through the towering palace, taking each floor at a time, Torrin scales the outside wall until he reaches the royal chambers. There he meets up with Halion, kills the wretch Rorsarsh, and secures the boy emperor, though in truth he had no idea what they were going to do with the child. "What do we do about the elves, or the Arrakesh?" Brego asked. Torrin had left out telling the elves about the elves, as he didn't want to complicate matters. But everyone knew the assassins were lurking in the shadows. The White Owl had told them to overwhelm the assassins if confronted. Superior numbers was the only way they could beat the legendary warriors. "Once we take the palace and hold the Emperor hostage, they will be forced to flee." The main gate remained partially open after Argo walked through. That was the signal. If the gates had closed completely, then there was something wrong, and the guards had changed. Brego cupped his hands together and imitated the call of an owl. The reaction was immediate, with the surrounding buildings lining the edge of the palace walls coming to life. Owls dashed out from their hiding places and made for the wall with their grappling equipment, while Torrin made his way down into the alley and headed for the main gate. Carath was silent, but for the light footfalls of the running owls. No one yelled in defiance, and no horns were blown in alarm, as the owls quickly made their way over the wall and into the palace gardens. Torrin looked through the holes in his mask and examined the expressions of the guards on the gate, searching for any sign of betrayal. As ordered, the guards closed the gates and barred the massive doors behind him. It would require many hours of battering to open the gate from the outside. No talking was needed when the owls descended upon the royal estate. Their years on the streets had gifted them many skills. Chief among them was the ability to move unseen and unheard. Those natural talents, combined with the training he had passed on from Salim, made them a deadly opponent. Torrin ran through the gardens, between the palm trees and thick hedges, with a throwing knife in each hand, ready to silence any guards that were off their patrol routes. A pair of soldiers dropped in the distance without a sound, as a group of owls ambushed them on the path. Torrin paid them little attention, and instead began his climb up the palace walls. Brego gave him an affirming nod from below and disappeared into the palace with the owls at his back. So far, everything had gone according to plan, with no loss of life on their side. Torrin pushed any thoughts from his mind and focused on the climb. He was well accomplished in scaling almost every surface, but he had never attempted anything as tall as the palace. Then again, he had never seen anything outside of Carath. It took just over an hour to reach the balcony belonging to one of the staterooms. Relieved, Torrin hopped over the edge and rubbed his sore forearms and flexed his fingers. The plush chamber held nothing of interest to the White Owl, and he crept into the hall in search of stairs. There was still some climbing to go. Argo's information continued to prove accurate, as he turned the corner and found the spiral staircase used by the palace's slaves. He took heart in the thought that the first few floors would already be under their control. Torrin stopped halfway up the staircase and held his breath. The sound of clinking armor and heavy footsteps echoed from above, descending towards him. The White Owl crept back the way he had come and flattened himself to the wall at the base of the staircase. There wasn't supposed to be any patrols in this wing, but the two guards were pleasantly chatting about their next meal. Torrin couldn't tell which soldiers were sympathetic to the cause, so he left his blades in their sheaths. Steel wasn't required to subdue a pair of ordinary guards, though he would never tell Halion such a thing. As they took their last step off the staircase, Torrin swung his arm into the nearest guard with the edge of his flattened hand. The side of his knuckle connected with the man's throat and launched him back up the staircase in a choking mess. The second guard jumped in surprise, a crucial moment in which he might otherwise have put up a fight. Torrin, however, was already dropping to one knee, and in the same fluid motion, he pushed his elbow into the man's knee, bringing them both to the same level. The White Owl jumped back to his feet, while simultaneously removing the guard's helmet, where he could thrust the man's exposed head into the spiraling banner. He was unconscious before he hit the floor, unlike the first guard, who was rolling around the stairs in a desperate bid to suck some air into his lungs. Torrin grabbed him roughly by the collar, and similarly removed his helmet, so he wouldn't break his knuckles on the man's nose. To give him as much time as possible before any alarm was raised, Torrin dragged the bodies into the empty room and closed the door. He paused on the stairwell and tilted his head to listen for any commotion above or below. It seemed his owls were performing well, just as he had trained them. As he moved deeper into the palace, Torrin took stealthier measures to remain hidden from the increasing number of guards. By the time he was reaching the upper levels, he had but to simply follow his nose. Growing up on the streets gave him a particular affinity for sniffing out food, especially when it had been cooked by the royal chefs. At the final corridor, he came face to face with the door that separated him from the Supreme Commander and the boy Emperor. Something wasn't right. The corridor should be lined with honor guards, where Selim had once stood, ready to give their life for the Emperor. The smell of the cooked meat told Torrin that the feast was definitely beyond the door, but there was no talk on the other side. Something was definitely wrong. Torrin knew he should find the nearest window and blow a clear note on the horn he carried on his belt. That would alert the owls that the plan was to be immediately abandoned, and they should meet back up at dawn in the south of the city. But he didn't. Torrin had come this far, and curiosity had wormed its way into his mind. Checking every alcove and shadow, Torrin slowly approached the double doors with the lightest of feet. With his ear pressed to the door, he was sure he could hear the sound of Rorsash's greedy mouthfuls. He had to know. The white owl steadied his breathing and tried to recall some words of wisdom from Salim's teachings, but nothing came to mind. He just wanted to kill and tear and destroy the lives of those who inflicted so much misery on the arid lands. The son of Nun thrust open the door with two throwing knives balanced in one hand, ready to throw at whoever attacked him first. Torrin lost all heart at the sight that greeted him, his bloodlust immediately dispirited. Through dark, swollen eyes, Halion lifted his battered head and looked upon his brother with despair. "I'm sorry," Halion croaked with watery, bloodshot eyes. His brother was strapped to an expensive-looking chair in the middle of the chamber, with his hands bound behind his back. His armor and clothes had been stripped and tossed aside so that he sat naked, covered from head to toe in blood, both fresh and dry. Halion had been sat in that chair for some time. His face was barely recognizable after all the blows he had received, and his flesh was marred with burns and gaping wounds. His bare feet slipped around atop the puddle of blood beneath his chair. Torrin dragged his sight from Halion and looked at the man in white, standing beside him. Next to him was another man with broad shoulders and a thick jaw. He was an Arrakesh by the looks of him, but he didn't have the red cloth around his eyes, only the blades on his back. Off to the side, Rorsash gorged himself on a large piece of meat, his appetite unaffected by the smell of blood and piss. Emperor Farrow was nowhere to be seen, he noted. "You must be the white owl I keep hearing about." The man in flowing white robes flashed a confident smile his way. "I applaud your skill, young warrior, for not just anyone can slay an Arrakesh, let alone three." The man swept his robes behind his back and slowly walked behind Halion. "This must come as a bit of a surprise, I'm sure. You were expecting to take this palace and reset the order of things in Karath, nay, the entire arid lands." There was a note of respect in his tone, if a hint of mocking. "Where are my manners? My name is Aladir Yalathanil. This is Rodo Sarn, your brother's personal torturer. And of course, I'm sure you know Supreme Commander Rorsash over there." Torrin wanted to respond to the elf, but his rage kept his lips sealed and his muscles tensed. "Run!" Halion strained against his bonds. "Run!" "Will that be all, father?" The familiar voice came from behind Torrin, in the doorway. The white owl swiveled round to see Argo standing perfectly at ease. How had he approached Torrin without being heard? "Thank you, Argo," Aladir replied. "Find the others and kill them all." Argo nodded and removed his helmet, only to replace it with a strip of red cloth across his eyes. Torrin felt his knees go weak at the revelation. An Arrakesh had walked freely through the orphanage, telling them what they wanted to hear via secrets gained from Halion's bloody lips. The entire plan was unraveling before him, and there was nothing he could do to stop it. The House of Owls was going to fall. The elf in white lost his smile. Unlike my kin across the Aegean, I have borne witness to the rise and fall of your various kingdoms over the last millennium. I have seen firsthand the treachery and deceit your kind are capable of. I was there when King Galtion, the first of his name, rallied mankind and forced the elves out of Ilion. I was there when he declared war on the dragons. I was there when his most trusted turned against him. You might say I have a unique insight into humanity. Aladir pulled Halion's head back by his thick hair. I know a rat when I see one. You will die for this, Torin replied through gritted teeth. Aladir gave a short laugh. It has been a long time since I entertained the thought of my death. I see no reason why I should consider it today. Rorschach finally stopped eating. Your rebellion is at an end, little owl. The new dawn will rule these lands for all time. Torin's hand twitched, and one of the throwing knives took flight. The blade found its end, deep inside the Supreme Commander's throat. He gargled and dropped to his knees, with fresh blood pouring from his mouth. The fat man's face quickly turned red, then purple, before he finally collapsed on the floor, dead. Well, that saves me a job, Rhodo Sarin commented. Torin let fly his second blade with another casual throw, aimed to strike the assassin in the head. At the last moment, Aladir stepped in and amazingly caught the knife mid-throw, inches from Rho's face. Elven speed was a wonder to watch, if terrifying. Aladir examined the small blade. You have but this one chance to live, and maybe even save your brother's life. Lead the Karathan forces and put your skills to good use. The Darkerkin are coming through those gates. At least, this way you will maintain a measure of control and keep your city from being reduced to ash under their heel. Before the White Owl could respond, Aladir spoke again. Take care, Torin, son of Nun. Your next words might well be your last. Torin looked at Halion, bloody and battered as tears cut lines through his swollen cheeks. Even now, his owls were being hunted down inside the palace, and slaughtered by the assassins. Should he take the offer and save Halion's life at least? He didn't care about his own life, but he couldn't bear to see his brother lose another drop of blood. The thought of giving up now was crippling, however. Torin had been fighting for as long as he could remember, and not just for the sake of fighting, like so many did on the streets. He had been fighting for a cause greater than himself, or any of the owls for that matter. It was a cause even greater than his adoptive brother. With one hand concealed behind his dark cloak, Torin gripped the coiled rope and felt for the four-pronged hook. He wanted to say something, anything that would leave them with a lasting impression of the atrocities Torin would unleash upon them when they next met, or at least assure Halion that he would return to save him. But Salim's teachings were ever present in his mind, and warned him of such foolishness. His best chance of escape was over the open balcony to his left. Giving no indication, Torin dashed to his left, his cape blowing out behind him. That was when the shadowed figure stepped out of the darkness. Had he been standing there the entire time? How had Torin not noticed his presence? He had no time to ponder on the questions, however, as a whip, which appeared to glow from within its strands, lashed out. The three prongs at the head of the whip caught the white owl across the mask and sent him flying across the room. The helmet had been cracked from jaw to head, and even cut Torin above the eye. How could a whip cause so much damage? The shadowy figure stepped into the light, and Torin saw the face that would surely be the death of him. It was another elf, like Aladir, but bald and very pale, with intricate tattoos arching over his head. His armor was black and gold, with similar glyphs to his tattoos worked into the plating. This had to be Nakir Galvord. You have been an irritation for some time, Nakir called his whip and replaced it on his hip. I hear you have been trained by an honor guard. The elf looked back to Halion, the source of his knowledge. It was I who created the honor guard, centuries ago, to protect my interests. My teachings and techniques have been passed down through the ages to keep the emperor safe. What good is a puppet if its strings are cut? Nakir turned his back on Torin and walked away. Let us see what you have learned, White Owl. Torin placed his hands either side of his head and flipped back onto his feet. The owl mask was broken, but he could still see clearly. More than anything, he wanted to headbutt the elf so that the jagged metal might cut into his pale skin. Selim's teachings and words of wisdom abandoned him now. Torin could only see red. The White Owl launched into an attack that would confuse, disarm, and defeat any soldier in the army. But Nakir was no soldier. He was an elf that had been fighting in wars before the arid lands had even been named so. Nakir moved with the grace of a cat and the supernatural speed of a basilisk. Their arms and fists connected in a series of blows that was hard to follow, but every attack of Torin's was either blocked, pushed aside, or used against him. Eventually Nakir pulled Torin into him and rammed his pale head into the owl mask, before landing a simple punch to his sternum. The combination of blows sent Torin flying across the room once more. Somehow Torin had come off worse from being hit in the head, and was forced to blink several times to correct his vision. "Your technique shows promise," Nakir's raspy voice commented. "But you haven't been forced to give your all for some time. I suppose killing slavers and running into the occasional patrol doesn't offer much challenge." Torin managed to stand up and stretch his back until it cracked. Defeating Nakir wasn't an option right now. He had been surprised and caught off guard. If he was ever to challenge the elf, it would need to be on a field of his choosing. The balcony was on the other side of Nakir, and it was still his best chance at escape. Aladir and Rhodosarn continued to stand by Halion and watch them fight. Had they chosen to get involved, Torin would be dead by now. Relying on his anger to grant him one last burst of energy, Torin ran at the elf and jumped at the last second to bring his foot up into Nakir's jaw. The elf easily stepped aside and pushed Torin's foot away, before following up with another series of punches and elbows that forced the White Owl into the wall. Torin slid to the floor and spat blood into his mask. One of his ribs was definitely broken, and his armor did nothing to soften Nakir's blows. For all the pain he was actually in, Torin played heavily on his suffering and made it appear worse than it was. He slowly crawled on all fours and groaned as he attempted to stand, adding in a stumble to his performance. Nakir laughed. "I'm not sure you could even stand up against an honor guard. How you defeated 3 Arrakesh is beyond me." Torin sucked in a breath, aware that his next actions would cause considerable pain. Using his cloak to conceal his hands, Torin quietly removed the blade from his waist as he rose into a crouch. His hand flew out, stretching his chest and pulling at his broken rib, while releasing the blade in Nakir's direction. As expected, the elf caught the knife before it could plunge into his neck, but that had not been the point of the attack. Torin dashed to the left again, and dived cleanly over the railing with his grapple already in hand. The White Owl allowed himself to fall to the next floor down, before throwing the grapple over a smaller, curved balcony. The hook snagged and became taut, but Torin's injuries proved too much, and his grip loosened under the sharp pinch from his ribs. His halted fall prevented him from breaking anything, after dropping down another floor and landing awkwardly on the next balcony. He was just thankful the staterooms had been built with symmetry. It took everything he had to climb fully over the railing and onto the balcony floor. He was now 2 floors below Halion and the elves, but still inside a palace filled with Arrakesh. As painful as it was, Torin drew in a long breath and blew into the curved horn. He could only hope that it carried enough to warn any who had yet to be set upon by the Arrakesh. Torin tried not to think about Halion, and instead thought of how he would escape the palace. If he could survive this, there was still a chance that he could return and save his brother. If he could escape. Torin ran through the lavish hallways with abandon, all attempts at stealth forgotten. Clashing swords rang out, echoing off the hard walls, along with the sound of his owls crying out in defeat. The House of Owls was well trained, but they were no match for the Arrakesh. The White Owl blew into the horn again and again, in hopes of signaling his friends. Leaving the slave hallways behind, Torin headed deeper into the palace until he came across a grand staircase. Warriors of his house fought for their lives against the assassins, who pushed them back down the stairs, away from the double doors that led further into the palace. The 3 Arrakesh, one of which was Argo, were all dressed in the garb of Carathan soldiers, but they had replaced their helmets with strips of red cloth. "Run!" Torin screamed as he jumped onto the stairwell, attacking the assassins from behind. The distraction saved the life of a young female owl, who was helped to her feet by the others. They looked at Torrin for guidance, but he only screamed at them to run away again. Hesitantly, the group rallied around the injured female warrior and retreated back to the gardens. The three blind assassins lunged for Torrin as one, working together in harmony. Despite using the weapons of the guards and not their usual twin blades, the Arrakesh fought with grace and deadly precision. Torrin was forced to ignore the pain in his ribs and evade the multitude of strikes that aimed to remove his limbs. The White Owl threw small knives here and there, but the acute senses of the assassins always prevailed, allowing them to easily dodge the flying blades. A misstep on the stairs put Torrin in the path of a roundhouse kick that connected with his already broken mask. The young fighter went spinning across the landing with a mouthful of blood. The pain made him angry. He stood up, all pain forgotten, and swiftly removed the two short swords concealed upside down on his back. Two lunging moves put the assassins on a retreating foot, but their balance on the stairs was impeccable, and the three killers battered aside his attacks and slowly circled him. How long could he really keep this up? Torrin was already injured and outnumbered, and who knew how long it would be before one of the elves showed up to finish him off. It didn't matter, he told himself. He only needed to give the owls more time to escape. Torrin! Rago came charging into the foyer at the bottom of the staircase with six owls, all armed with bows. Six twangs unleashed a barrage of arrows at the assassins, who either cut the projectiles down or evaded the tips. For Torrin, it was his best opening. The White Owl lashed out with both swords and took out the legs of one, while bringing the weapons up and into another's chest. The Arrakesh, who had been cut to his knees, succumbed to the next barrage of arrows, leaving only one. Argo. Torrin pulled free his swords from between the plates of armor and watched the bloodied body collapse at the survivor's feet. Surrender, Torrin rasped. Argo slowly turned his head. Where you were taught to surrender, I was taught to survive. The treacherous Arrakesh leapt from halfway up the staircase with his sword held high. Brago and the owls braced themselves and even managed to hit the assassin with two arrows as he descended. Torrin half leapt, half ran down the stairs, but the assassin was already amongst them, cutting through the owls with trained ease. By the time Torrin was within striking distance, Argo had cut through the group and killed four of the seven warriors. The White Owl attacked Argo with a flurry of swordplay, each attack designed to push the assassin back, away from the others. It made little difference. Even with two arrows in his shoulder and leg, Argo slipped past Torrin and plunged his sword into Brago's stomach.
No!
Torrin cried, his shock holding him in place as his oldest friend received a mortal wound. Before he could counterattack, Argo spun around and kicked Brago into Torrin, driving them both to the floor. The surviving owls retrieved their bows and forced Argo to flee through a side door.
Brago!
Torrin held his friend in his arms as blood spilled onto the floor.
Quickly! He ordered the owls. Take him! We need to retreat!
The owls picked Brago up and dragged him out into the gardens. Torrin blew again and again into his horn and looked around frantically, searching for any more assassins in the shadows. He quickly followed behind the trailing Brago and looked on in horror as his friend's blood streaked the floor. They had failed. He had failed. Part 3 Chapter 19 Anti-Magic. Gideon looked on in wonder when the morning sun filled the small clearing and caught the blade of the ancient Dragorn sword. Mornblade's pommel, the sleek head of a dragon, glittered and shimmered in the light. The mage had never been interested in swords, always relying on his magic or the strength of his staff. But something about this blade called to him. He had sat on the soft grass for most of the last 2 days, simply marveling at it, while his leg got better. It had been a relatively lonely time, as Galanor often retreated to the higher perches of the floating boulders, and Adriel had avoided them entirely. It was easily done, considering the size of Dragon's Reach. Oddly, Gideon had noted more the absence of Ilargo. The green dragon had been injured, saving him from Maliath's rampage, but he was confident the young dragon would heal quickly. That particular confidence came from the fact that Gideon's own injury, in exactly the same place, had already healed. Before he could truly consider the implications of that connection, Galanor walked into the clearing.
The elf had deliberately made some noise to announce his arrival, as he was more than capable of creeping up on Gideon. It was a consideration the elf would have once foregone.
"Why do you continue to stare at that thing?"